Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And happy summer, everyone. And it's Friday, so let's jump right into our week in review, starting with a big disagreement over the wisdom, over the idea of hosting the 2024 Olympic Games.
In a televised debate last night, Steve Pagliuca, the chair of Boston 2024, said bringing the Olympics to Boston could push the city into the future.
I think this is a once-in-a-lifetime economic development opportunity to take Boston to the next level. We need to move Boston forward. The Olympics can be a catalyst to do that.
But Chris Dempsey, co-chair of No Boston Olympics, took issue with that, saying hosting the Games would be a potentially costly gamble for the city.
We see that the bid requires building the three most expensive Olympic venues, that every Olympics since 1960 has gone over budget, and that Boston 2024 is asking taxpayers to sign a guarantee to cover those overruns.
Last night's debate went deep into the weeds of Olympic funding, tax subsidies, and traffic, and it comes just 2 months before the U.S. Olympic Committee will decide whether or not to officially back Boston's bid.
So did last night change the debate at all? And to answer that question and some others, and to talk about the rest of the week's news, we're joined by Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe. Very nice to see you here.
Great to be here.
Also with us is John Carroll. He's a professor of communications at Boston University and a senior analyst for WBUR. John, always good to have you.
Always good to be here.
So let me start. Did this debate change the conversation on the Olympic proposal? What do you think, John?
Well, first of all, not to go all Eddie Haskell on you, but I listened to the debate on WBUR, Mrs. Cleaver, and it was a very different debate on the radio than it was on television.
Interesting. So explain that.
I saw some clips afterwards. The Boston 2024 people felt like they were really bullying, felt like they were disrespectful, felt like they were monopolizing the time. And I haven't seen a breakdown of how much time each side got, but it really felt disproportionately weighted on the side of Boston 2024. That said, I think that essentially they lost some of the goodwill that they might have garnered by bringing up Daniel Doktorov from New York. I mean, I think it's pretty widely accepted that he was condescending, he was superior, he was dismissive.
Fact, and the No Boston Olympics people sort of jumped on that and said, hey, you bring up an out-of-towner, not a good thing.
Right, absolutely. And also, you know, in New York, they had put a cap on overruns, how much they would be responsible for in New York when they made their bid for the Olympics, and asked why Boston 2024 wouldn't put the same kind of cap on. What's good for New York is good for Boston. He said, well, times have changed. So I think that from that standpoint, that was a strategic misstep on the part of Boston 2024.
Dante, what did you take away from last night's debate?
I thought ultimately that it really doesn't change the dynamics of this discussion all that much. What the Boston 2024 people have failed to do up to this point is put to rest some of the deeper doubts about whether taxpayers are going to be on the hook for cost overruns. And as John pointed out, the fact that previous Olympic bids in the United States have had certain limitations on what taxpayers are expected to fork over if things go wrong does raise the question of why that such an impossibility this time around. I tend to agree also that Dan Doktorov's performance, you know, it came off to many Boston viewers, I suspect, as New York explaining about why Bostonians should have the Olympics. I thought actually, on the other hand, that Steve Pagliuca seemed to be very much in command of the details, and projected a certain confidence, and you got the sense that they had thought through certain financial details. What's difficult about that setting is the discussion of whether the Olympics are a good idea or a bad idea does depend ultimately on, you know, the square footage rate of the cost of renting out thus and such at Wydad Circle. And that's a really difficult thing to adjudicate on TV.
Yeah, there were some real eye-glazing sections of the debate where they got totally lost in the weeds. And I think that if there was one criticism of Steve Pagliuca, who I think came off much better on television because he's a pleasant guy. He didn't look angry than he did on radio. But if there was one thing that I thought he came up short on was he felt really programmed. He kept using the same words over and over again: inflammatory, hyperbole, catalyst. It was all that like it had been drilled into him by the consultants to use this kind of language.
Well, speaking of getting lost in the weeds, I just want to read a quick quote from Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy, who wrote this about the debate. He said both sides bombarded us with numbers. You need a Ken Burns 10-part series to shed light on all of the flaws in the Boston 2024 blueprint, but we had to settle for 1 hour. Anyway, that was from Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy. But let's hear from Steve Pagliuca. So he said that backers, once people learn about the plan, it will attract more backers to the idea of bringing the Olympics to Boston. Here's what he said.
There's an incredible thing in this for Boston. If you take the word Olympics away and you said, we have an economic development project that's going to bring close to $5 billion into the region, that's a pretty attractive thing to look at.
So that's Steve Pagliuca. Here's Chris Dempsey, head of the group of the group No Boston Olympics, saying the plan doesn't include funding to fix some of the biggest problems in the city.
We should be very clear that Boston 2024 is not proposing to take private dollars and to invest them in the team. They have a $4.6 billion Olympic budget, and not a penny goes to improvements for the MBTA.
So I'm wondering about that last point. I mean, Dante, is it Boston 2024's job to fix the MBTA?
I don't think it's Boston 2024's job to fix the T. At the same time, the impetus for doing this, the civic impetus, is partly that it becomes an occasion to revamp some of the things in the city that need revamping. And that's actually, you know, for other cities, that has proved to be a moderately compelling rationale. There's a deadline there. It makes you make a list of things that you need to do. But I think Dempsey is right in saying that Boston 2024 isn't proposing a package of improvements, certainly isn't proposing to pay for them. Personally, I think even if they were proposing some improvements and asking the public explicitly to pay for certain things, it would come across as more credible. Instead, they're in the situation where they're saying that certain things will be catalyzed, but not totally identifying what they are, and certainly not identifying how those things are going to get paid for.
I want to talk about one more little wrinkle in this. There was some news this afternoon. The Associated Press reports that the U.S. Olympic Committee has given Governor Baker until the end of today to say whether he supports bringing the Games to Boston or not. Now, this afternoon, Baker said he won't decide until next month, when he expects to get a report from a consultant group analyzing the potential impact of the Games. But, John, I am sort of struck by this idea of how important, or let me ask the question this way, how important is it that the governor sort of say one way or the other whether he supports this?
It's critical, I think, because the state's going to be on the hook, I think, as much as the city's going to be on the hook. And especially now that they've spread the Olympics out from what was a fairly compact footprint to all over the state, I think it's critical that he get on board. I can't believe the USOC came out and gave him an ultimatum. This is typical of these guys. They just can't handle the sort of the mechanics of doing this. Whenever they're presented with a choice, they seem to make the wrong one. And just one last thing. Steve Pagliuca says the more people learn about this, the more they approve of it. I think the polls have actually proven the opposite, that the more they learn about it, the less they like it. But we'll see what happens out of the debate.
So a topic for another time would be, like, what if there was a casino down in Copley Square or, you know, at Lechmere? Because the mitigation money, that would fix the tea, you know?
Sure.
A downtown casino. Okay, we'll get to that another point. We're going to shift gears quite a bit right now and talk about the story of a 7-year-old boy from Hardwick who is right now in a coma. He's in state custody since July 14th. His father, Randall Lintz, was arrested this week for allegedly assaulting his son, whose name is Jack. And his son, Jack, is suffering from dehydration and starvation. He came into the ER with bruises and burns. The state's Department of Children and Families, DCF, is now saying that it had been monitoring the family since February. And Jack's mother is speaking to the press. She spoke to WBUR reporter David Boeri. Her name is Amber Loisel, and here's what she had to say.
My personal feelings are that I'm upset that this happened to my son and that something could have been done. He has the most beautiful soft blonde hair. He was squeezing my hand and I just know that he's going to come back.
And we all hope that. John, Carol, there's still a lot we don't know about the story, but this once again highlights problems at the DCF that could be systemic. It could be a matter of staffing. It's also under a new governor.
Right. This one is really discouraging. I mean, it's tragically sad what happened to this young boy. And there are two cardinal sins, I think, at DCF. One is indifference. The other is incompetence. And I think that this is one where it wasn't indifference so much as incompetence that led to this situation. They watched this boy deteriorate over time. And the fact that no one stepped in and said, what's going on here? He's got burns on his feet. He's lost 12 to 15 pounds in a couple of months. He weighed 38 pounds when he went into the hospital. The fact that that wasn't a trigger signaling to them something needs to be done here, some intervention needs to be taken, I think says so many worse things about DCF than we had sort of previously assumed.
So we'll be taking a much closer look at this story a little bit later in the show. But Dante Ramos, Governor Baker signed the state budget into law last week, and it did include a lot more money, $37 million additional dollars for DCF. From social workers, we hear, and I've heard this when I'm at reporting, that staffing is a problem. There's too many caseloads per social worker. But is the funding a problem?
Funding has historically been a problem. It's not the only problem. One of the things that's horrible in these situations, in this case, is absolutely hideous. The social workers who are looking at these situations, and I agree with John, you know, a child doesn't waste away to 38 pounds overnight, and presumably there's something that people who've been monitoring the family would have noticed. It's also worth remembering that DCF social workers are seeing children in very hideous situations often and are making choices between taking the child away and sending them to, you know, parts unknown, or leaving them with a parent who may be show certain signs of caring and not, but also be having trouble. And it's difficult to say in those moments, you know, how every possibility is going to shake out. Now, as far as the funding goes, you know, Governor Baker has made DCF a key test in a way of the efficacy of government. If you recall from the governor's race last fall, he had talked about the case where a boy went missing, or these children being found in horrible circumstances. He'd used that as an example, essentially, of how state government had withered away in some of its ability to manage its affairs under Deval Patrick. And there's now more money in the budget. This is a real test of his ability, with his having made this an issue, to make this always troubled agency function better.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to bring this next point up also in a little bit later this hour. But I want to know, like, if a company has a fail rate that is so excessive, the company the board of overseers would maybe get rid of the top director, the executive director, but they would also look at how the system is working or not working. So, John Carroll, last word on this. Is the state really doing enough to protect children if it's not really looking at the system of how DCF is run?
First of all, let me just say, this is really hard work. So it's easy to blame the social workers. This is really difficult work to do. And I think that money is one of the issues, but judgment is another part of the issue. And I think that that what they need to do, perhaps, is put some money into more training, put some money into basically helping the social workers do their jobs better. I don't want to sit here and pass judgment on them, because, as I said, it's really hard work. But this one was one where it should have been clear. And it apparently wasn't.
Right. And just to be clear, I mean, I understand from social workers I've spoken to that what they're facing is having to travel across the state. Their cases, whom they have to check in on, these kids or these families, whether it's once a month or once every 3 weeks, they could be in Greenfield and their cases outside of Boston. So that's another issue. That's a system issue. And we'll talk more about that in a few minutes.
Yeah, big, big challenge. Okay, let's move on to another big local issue that's popped up on the national agenda, the idea of sanctuary cities. These are cities that have pledged not to cooperate with federal efforts to round up unauthorized immigrants. There are six of them here in Massachusetts, including Chelsea, Somerville, and Cambridge, along with three others. But following the killing of a woman in San Francisco by an unauthorized immigrant, Republicans in the House yesterday passed legislation to deny federal funds to sanctuary cities. This week on the show, we heard from former Cambridge City Councilor and Mayor Alice Wolfe. She wrote the original law that made Cambridge a sanctuary city back in the 1980s. Here's what she said.
In cities, we do have we have resonance. We have people who are here, who are part of our fabric of our lives. They have families. Most of them are working. They're paying taxes and so forth. And we do have a responsibility, I think, as cities and as elected officials in cities to protect them.
We also spoke with Thomas O'Loughlin. He's the chief of police in the town of Milford, which is not a sanctuary city, and he took issue with the whole idea. Here's what he said.
You find in sanctuary cities, for instance, that the elected officials have directed law enforcement officials not to cooperate with federal agents, to not follow secured communities. So, you know, in essence, they are protecting criminals.
So, Dante, what's your take on this debate about sanctuary cities?
It's ironic to me that the House snapped into action on this front. Sanctuary cities is one of many areas in which local communities are trying to improvise solutions, essentially, to a national immigration problem in which the law of the country and the reality of immigrants in the country are in two completely different places. And, mm-hmm. you know, many times a day, law enforcement agencies, elected officials, people at all levels of government have to figure out what to do in situations where there are a lot of illegal immigrants who are very well integrated into the economy, have children and families often who have legal status. And it creates all of these very difficult ethical situations. One of the reasons that sanctuary cities exist is a law enforcement reason, in fact. Some people believe that when illegal immigrants, people without authorization, are not in danger when they speak to police of being deported, more crimes get solved. Mm-hmm. Things like domestic violence are more likely to be dealt with, and that this is a positive law enforcement strategy. Obviously, you heard from the police chief in Milford that he doesn't agree with that, but these are decisions that local communities will make in different ways, and they have to. They're in a bad situation.
Well, it's true, but I mean, on the other hand, and whether it's exceptional or not, I mean, what happened in San Francisco, when you read the details of that story, it really does make you scratch your head. I mean, you know, I have no trouble with the idea of sanctuary cities and protecting folks and not splitting up families and lots of undocumented immigrants. Of course, they're peaceful people and they're working hard. But this was a guy that had been tracked. The sheriff knew he was bad news, and they wanted to be alerted when he was released from custody, and they weren't, and out he went, and he committed this awful crime. So it seems like there ought to be a way to have sanctuary cities that don't also protect people like that. I don't know. What do you think, John?
Well, I think there are legalistic arguments for not holding illegal immigrants when the Immigration and Customs Enforcement isn't there to take them, mm-hmm. because technically that's false imprisonment, according to some in the legal community. So that presents a difficulty. But the alerting of the ICE officials is something that I think is a concern that the federal government is trying to become more vigilant about, and especially to toss to the ICE officials in terms of serious crimes. I think that's something that a lot of people are in favor of, regardless of how they feel about sanctuary cities, that those alerts should be made. But holding them indefinitely with no charges against them, I think that becomes problematic.
All right, last topic and quick before we get to a little fun, taxes, not fun, and the possibility of more of them for some of the top wage earners in Massachusetts. You may have heard that this coalition of labor unions and religious organizations and advocacy groups, liberal ones in particular, want to amend the state's constitution to move away from the flat tax and hike the income tax by an additional 4% on anyone earning $1 million or more. Nobody in this room, I don't think. Massachusetts voters have rejected these efforts, you know, five times in the past, but advocates are hoping that, you know, a sixth effort will be the charm. Do you think so?
I think they're overplaying their hand. There is definitely a feeling, a sort of resurgence of the traditional progressive left. This is an argument that I think probably has more potency than in the past. The rates that they're proposing are probably stiffer than voters would be willing to accept.
John, do you think it's just that people don't want to pay higher taxes?
Well, this affects 14,000 people in Massachusetts. So essentially, it's different from the graduated income tax that was defeated 2-1 in 1994, which basically was going after people who made $150,000 as opposed to over $1 million. civilian. So I think a lot of it's going to be in terms of how this is framed, who gets to define the terms first, and I think that'll determine the outcome.
Okay.
All right. Let's move on. We've got just time enough for our hubbubs, those stories that might not have made it to the top of the newscast, those below the fold items that caught the interest of our panelists. Dante, let me start with you. What's your hubbub?
If you've ever used sneakers, you've probably owned a pair of Chuck Taylors, the iconic basketball shoe that Converse introduced in 1917. They're known for their flat white rubber soles, and they haven't changed in about 98 years. This week, Converse launched the Chuck Taylor 2, a more comfortable high-tech sneaker with a Lunarlon insole. Lunarlon, by the way, I think is a combination of foam and pseudoscience. It's hard to quibble with more comfort. It's just funny that at a time when Polaroid cameras and fixed gear bikes are coming back, Converse's Chuck Taylors are finally getting an update.
John, what about you?
Well, my hubbub is about YouTube sensation Jenna Marbles, real name Jenna Mori, who's a proud daughter of Boston. She graduated from Suffolk University with a BS in psychology from BU, Go Terriers, with a master's in sports psychology and counseling. She has a YouTube channel with 15 million subscribers. She's posted 200 videos and gotten 1.8 billion views for videos such as, and let me just say she's wildly profane and very popular. One of her most popular videos is the drunk makeup tutorial, which has gotten 20 million views.
As in how to put on, not listening.
As in how to put on makeup when you're drunk.
Exactly. And she followed it up with this video. After dogged research for hours, I found 20 seconds we can actually play on NPR. This is the follow-up to the drunk makeup tutorial.
When you go day drinking, it's really hard to like do your makeup when you're hammered. It's equally as hard to do your hair when you're hammered. So I decided that I want to attempt the most incredibly ambitious hairdo I can think of. Step one, I guess, is going to be to get drunk.
All right.
Okay, this is very important. You kids at home, do not try this, okay?
What did the hairdo look like, John?
It was fabulous.
What was she drinking?
Jenna Marbles is a semi-professional. She works under the constant supervision of her boyfriend, so don't try this at home. Here's the news, though. Madame Tussauds in New York just announced that it's set to introduce its first ever wax figure of a social media celebrity, and that is Boston's own Jenna Marbles. It'll probably look very much like the drunk Jenna Marbles, and it's going to be unveiled later this year. I think this is something every Bostonian can be proud of.
And we'll be there live, no doubt. Jill,
this
what
is
about
so
you?
Unfair to have to follow that. Are you kidding me? All right, so this is a story that only becomes a news item in the sense of misinformation, like Orson Welles and his War of the Worlds broadcast that, you know, sent radio listeners at the time into quite a panic. So if you come across the following, don't call 911. If you happen to see one of Dutch artist Theo Janssen's creatures on Boston City Hall Plaza next month or possibly up at Cranes Beach, they are taller than a tall person. They're as wide as, you know, two lanes of highway. There's different sizes. These are kinetic sculptures, so they move under their own power, and they move with, you know, wind and water in these PVC pipes. And Janssen calls them, and if anybody speaks Dutch, it would help, strandbeasts.
Which anybody? Means beach animals.
Very good. Very good. You just read my copy. It means beach animals. And they are made from these pipes and plastic bottles. And he gives them organs. So some have stomachs. Those are the recycled bottles. Others have sweat glands, which is water. And this goes through the pipes and the bottles. If you go to our website right now, you can see a video of one. And to me, they look like a cross between a colossal crab, but also like a lineup of kids trying on high heels, trying to be rockettes, walking in a line, trying to step over things. And they don't fall. So again, if you happen to see one at the beach, A, don't call 911. And B, if you stand next to it, the way it looks will make you look very good in your bathing suit. That's my hunch. And Jamie's as well, one of our producers.
They're pretty amazing.
You
should check it out at radioboston.org. Okay, finally, here's my hubbub. It concerns the hugely entertaining race for the Republican nomination for president now that Donald Trump is in the race. This week, we heard about how he gave out Lindsey Graham's cell phone number to the whole world. He said that John McCain was not a war hero, and he pretty much suggested that all Mexicans are drug-running terrorists. But there's been much less coverage of his tiff with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Now, because of those comments about Mexicans, Walsh recently told the Boston Herald that Trump will never be able to build a hotel in Boston until he apologizes to them. But last week, Trump went on the Howie Carr show and responded. So here's Trump, referring to himself in the third person as he does, responding to Mayor Walsh.
I think Walsh, whoever he may be, should absolutely apologize to Mr. Trump, because frankly, now everyone's apologizing to me because they realize I'm right. I expect him to apologize for me, and if he doesn't, the voters should vote him the hell out of office.
All right, so there's Donald Trump. A spokesman for Marty Walsh says the mayor will absolutely not apologize to Donald Trump. So there
Very presidential, as always.
Very presidential. All right, Dante Ramos of the Boston Globe, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. And John Carroll, always a pleasure to have you as well.
Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up, a young boy is abused, now in a coma under the Department of Children and Families. We're going to have more on this story. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.